chapter one starts with what you call transformational advocacy. What is that? How does it work?
Well, most people know protest marches. They know sign the petition, which I call transactional advocacy. Sign the petition, transaction complete. But with transformational advocacy, you're trained, encouraged, and succeed at doing things as an advocate you never thought you could do, like meet with a member of Congress and bring them on board to your issue. And a result of doing those things that you thought you couldn't do, you see yourself differently. You see yourself in a new light. And that's the transformational part of the advocacy.
The passive nature to our politics now, you can feel beat down by it. I mean, this is my career and I feel beat down by it. It is much more of an effort for me. I don't participate in the same way that others do because political journalists, but I do have to pay attention. It's a grind. It's a grind, Sam. I mean, I know you know that. What am I feeling? What's the way out of that? Maybe I'm not an activist, but you know what I'm saying.
Sure. Well, a couple things. Apollo astronaut Rushdie Schweikert once said, "We aren't passengers on spaceship Earth. We're the crew." Well,
yeah.
Are we? And if we are, what does crew act like? There's activist Alex Steffen said, cynicism is obedience. Well, if I'm cynical, then I'm just obedient to the way the things are, and I'm not getting in there and doing anything about it. So the bottom line is you have to look for these three things in an organization to see if it's up to transformational advocacy. The first thing is recruitment and building community. Do they bring new people in? I don't mean to build an e-blast list, but people talking to people to form them into chapters and then building community, an all of organization monthly webinar with guest speakers, Q&A, inspiration. Two, training. Are they training you to be more effective? How do you get the meeting? How do you plan for the meeting? Three, are they up for breakthroughs? There's a drawing in the book, small circle labeled your comfort zone. To the right is a larger circle labeled where the magic happens. Does the organization encourage you out of your comfort zone to do bigger things than you think you can do?
People want to get out of their comfort zone for this. I suppose it's a transformational process to take a step to do that.
Only after they've gotten it out do they want to get out. That's why you need a structure of support that can encourage you to do the things you might not at first want to or think you can do.
Polling certainly suggests that a lot of Americans just aren't happy with this 2024 race being asked to choose between Joe Biden or Donald Trump, probably. You've argued for a long time how important it is to use your vote, but say I've already decided that I can't bring myself to vote for either candidate. I'm just beaten down by it. What's wrong with that?
Well, let me say a couple things. In 2016, when Donald Trump was elected, 100 million Americans didn't vote. And when Joe Biden was elected, 80 million didn't vote. And the last midterm was the second highest youth vote ever. And 23% of youth voted. So we have a problem. There was an article, a column in the Boston Globe last year titled, "You Can Name the Three Stooges. Can you name your three members of Congress?"
Yeah.
Your rep and your two senators. And I'm sad to say, probably most people can't do that. So we need to find a way to activate people and get them into the game.
The first edition of your book came out in the 90s. I think it's fair to say that the political landscape and the culture have changed pretty drastically since then. You argue that change comes from listening to each other. I think that's a truism for sure. But we're in an environment now where politics is tribal, violence is in play now. A lot of politics is zero sum. A reasonable person might say solutions that worked 30 years ago, Sam, when you wrote your first edition, just aren't realistic right now.
Well, let me give you an idea of what I do with a group that's meeting with a member of Congress who's opposed to their bill. I have them ask three questions. One, we know you don't support this bill. What would it take to change your mind? Two, can you say more about that? Three, why do you think that is? It's basically a deep listening exercise, and I'm urging people to look for assignments. So, for example, there's a friend, a volunteer, who helped start the Climate Solutions Caucus in the House, and he asked that kind of question, and it was congressman said, well, if you could get the chambers of commerce on board. Well, he did. Well, if you could get the mayors on, he did. And so it's that kind of listening.
That politician is testing them to see if they'll
in it
do
for
what
the long run.
Trying to put them off.
Serious?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so to do those kinds of things, you can't do it winging it or as a solo actor. You really need to find a community, a structure of support that really will encourage you.
You've already mentioned the comfort zone and sort of putting yourself out there to be an activist or just to be involved in a way. I think you're talking about a way to be involved in all of this that isn't a passive, toxic grind, no matter where you are in the political spectrum.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, Moms for Liberty, a far right wing group that's doing a lot of things that make a lot of people unhappy, especially if they care about gay people and trans kids and the rest of it. They're in the arena. They're in the mix. They're not sitting watching Newsmax throwing things at the TV. They're out doing something.
Yeah. Well, so the whole thesis around transformational advocacy is left and right working together, finding ways, and not the bombastic fighting that goes on. Let me read one little quote from a volunteer. She's now on staff, but when she was a volunteer, she said, before I joined this group, Citizens Climate Lobby, I was suffering from climate trauma. I would read Bill McKibben's book, Earth, and I would weep at home and weep at work. And then she joins, she leads a workshop on getting relationships with editorial writers and members of Congress. And the last part, and just to read, it's mind-blowing. During our conference, I met with 20 congressional offices. I met with many folks whose view of the world was very different than mine. Going into their offices was hard. I had to let go of a lot of emotional baggage. I could no longer judge them or hold hostility in my heart toward them. I had to let go of my fear of climate change and my fear they wouldn't listen to me. I had to center myself in love. Releasing fear and centering in love, this is sacred and profound work. I don't think many people see advocacy, political advocacy, as sacred and profound, but it's a possibility and it's available.
To make it that.
Exactly.
You've already noted that being an activist in this way requires you to put yourself out there, to take a risk, to get out of your comfort zone. I hate to say it, doing that in the arena these days puts you at a greater risk than it used to of violence, not only online recrimination, people in your mentions, threats, but also threats of real violence. It is in play now. How does that make your case for transformational advocacy harder, or does it? Can you be in spaces where that isn't a risk?
Yeah, I'm talking about working with others. So, for example, if I feel that fear, I have two or three or four other friends who might work with me so I don't feel so alone. And I really urge people to not spend so much time online as much as offline. You know, more face-to-face with the member of Congress and meet the editor at the paper and that kind of thing. And engage in the most civil ways possible so they can make a bigger difference.
Now, you talked just a moment ago about voter registration, the millions, 100 million people who didn't vote in youth turnout, and you certainly write about the need to register more young voters. On one hand, voter turnout in 2020 was pretty stellar, right? There was high voter turnout, I think the highest in nearly a century, if not a century. On the other hand, January 6th and Donald Trump's continued dominance suggests that one of the political parties has checked out of the basic ideas of sharing power in a democracy.
Yeah.
They're over it. January 6th proved that, and so have a lot of other things. How do you view the health of the democracy given these very strange competing pieces of data?
Yeah, I keep looking at the health of the citizens. I mean, that's where I have some input. And so the question is, how many people are I waking up, and people whom I work with, are they waking up? It's like, what can we do? Rather than sitting on the couch and going, they're blowing out of there, I don't like what they're doing, what about what I'm doing? And how can I improve that piece of the puzzle? And so reclaiming our democracy shows a legitimate way of making a difference and healing our democracy in the process. It's not the only solution needed, but it's one essential missing piece. Citizens awakening to their power. And I don't think we're awake to that.
It sounds to me like this is a recipe you can shut off and turn away. This is a recipe to stay involved, but heal yourself in the process
exactly.
a little bit. That's what
exactly.
it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a great gift if you can get that far with your voice, with your democracy, that it's a healing experience rather than a shut off and turn off experience. Really important.
But you mentioned cynicism before we go and the importance of cynicism, that feeling, it doesn't matter anyway, this is beyond me, or there's a deep state that controls everything, or all of this is programmed. And many historians have written very clearly about this. Authoritarianism requires cynicism. It requires citizens to feel like they can't push back, they can't stop it, or it's all programmed, or everything is already set in motion. This is a required piece of authoritarianism succeeding.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, as I looked at citizens, I also look at the nonprofits. A recent study from the Independent Sector said only 31% of nonprofits were doing advocacy and lobbying. And it gets even worse. The Congressional Management Foundation asked advocacy professionals, what's their main method? And they said an email form letter. 79% said that, and only 3% of congressional staff said that made a real difference.
So what's my very first step? I want to turn off Fox News and do what tomorrow?
Well, I'd urge people to take a look at Reclaiming Our Democracy and find an organization that's committed to transformational advocacy.
That's Sam Daly Harris. He's the founder of Results, an international citizens lobby dedicating to creating the political will to end hunger and poverty. He's also the author of, you've heard it, Reclaiming Democracy, Every Citizen's Guide to Transformational Advocacy. Sam, I want to thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I also want to thank my guests earlier this hour, Daniel Kurtzleben of NPR and Republican political commentator and strategist Rena Shaw, helping us cover the race tomorrow in New Hampshire and the race beyond. A nice mix of electoral, hard-hitting politics and also the transformational kind that can keep you involved. Today's producer was Anna Casey. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. We'll talk to you soon. This is 1A.